Hello, this is Sky and Telescope Editor-in-Chief Robert Noya. I'm here in the S&T offices with Dr. Lisa Kaltenegger of the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics. Lisa is a renowned expert in the evolution of planetary atmospheres. She was one of the sources for Jeff Heck's cover story, Glimpses of an Evolving Planet, in our August issue. Lisa, thank you for joining the S&T podcast.
Thanks, Bob. It's great to be here.
Great. Jeff's article describes how Earth has changed profoundly during its 4.5 billion year history, and that as we start finding Earth-sized planets in the habitable zones around other stars, we will see these planets at different stages of their evolution. They're not going to all look exactly like Earth does right now. So you have worked on modeling how Earth's spectral signature has changed over Earth's history, representing billions of years. What are some of the biggest changes that alien astronomers on other planets would have seen if they could have taken spectra of Earth's atmosphere from the distance of nearby stars?
So if you're an alien astronomer and you saw the Earth, there's actually a couple of telltale signs that you could look for that indicates that it's a habitable planet, a tiny pale blue dot, as Sagan called it. So you can look for things like oxygen and methane and carbon dioxide and water. We think we need water for life to exist. Oxygen is produced by plants, and ozone is a tracer of that, so whether you see oxygen or ozone doesn't matter. And CO2 and water and methane actually are greenhouse gases, so that tells you how hot it is there in the first place. So a really interesting mix if you're an astronomer from far away, an alien trying to figure out if other habitable planets exist.
But I guess, like, if you were, let's say, today looking at Earth, you would see, in the infrared at least, you could see a nice spectral band for ozone, which would tell you there's oxygen in the atmosphere. And I would think, yeah, that's going to really pique the interest of an alien astronomer. But if you were, let's say, to look at Earth 2 billion years ago, would you have seen oxygen?
That's a really exciting thing. So we basically took Earth and had a look how long you'd be able to see that there's biota on it. And it's roughly about 50% of its lifetime that you can actually make out these features of oxygen with a reducing gas like methane. So you know lots of oxygen is produced, so you invoke biota for that, biological life. Before that, even the bacteria actually did produce things like carbon dioxide and methane that can also be produced without biology, but with biology. You can't really say that there's life on it, but, you know, 2 billion years, that's an amazing long time in Earth's history to be able to say that it's a habitat.
And how would we know? I mean, for example, the article mentions that you could find a planet with oxygen in the atmosphere, but that might just be from, you know, an oxygen-bearing molecule being broken up by sunlight. If you found, let's say, oxygen on another planet that's in a, you know, the habitable zone of its host star, what other things would you look for to really say, okay, we think there's life on that planet?
So the really interesting thing is actually that if you have a temperate environment, you can pretty much exclude that some of the molecules are broken up to actually leave a residual oxygen there. If it's too hot, there's no way that oxygen actually, well, there's no good way that oxygen indicates that there's life on it. But if you have a temperate environment and you have lots of oxygen, and again, a reducing gas, then that tells you that lots of oxygen is produced and we only have biota to figure that out. Of course, if you had a better telescope or a bit more funding, a bigger telescope, you could go and look for really small amounts of stuff in the atmosphere, trace gases, and there are a couple that we make, so you and me, and one of them, for example, that's a funny one, is freons that come out of your fridge. Whether or not that's intelligent life is up to debate, of course, because it destroys your ozone hole. But the good thing is you'll figure out that everybody makes the same mistakes, and that's kind of a nice thing to do. But so you go for low, small telescopes, low resolutions first, and then if you find something interesting, hopefully you have the funding to actually build a big telescope, keep staring and find smaller and smaller signs of evolved life.
And when we talk about these telescopes, for example, I know NASA has been talking about this terrestrial planet finder mission. What kind of capabilities are we talking about? First, to maybe just get a crude spectrum that might tell you that, you know, there's oxygen or water vapor, interesting gases, and then, like, what kind of bigger facility would you need to detect some of these trace gases that you were just talking about?
So we're basically talking about something like DARWIN or the Terrestrial Planet Finder. That's the mission we want to send in first. That basically is made out of one big telescope about 6 meters in space. That's the visible concept. So you block out the star with a mask and have a look at the planet that's next to the star. Or if you go to the infrared, where you see the heat of a body, planet or a star, you have more than one telescope. We right now envision three-meter telescopes working together that, again, mimic a mask, basically blocking out the light of the star and get the light from the planet. Those things are first-generation missions that we will use to actually figure out what's going on in the atmosphere of such a planet. And the great thing is, like, after that, if you just put a couple more telescopes together, instead of having three, give me 10, then you start to actually bring up the resolution, meaning that you just collect more light. And the more light you collect, the smaller signatures you can see. One other thing that's really interesting is that the thing that comes after Hubble, the James Webb Telescope, will have some capability. So if, by chance, the planet goes in front of the star, and light of the star basically hits the planetary atmosphere and goes to you, there's also going to be some absorption features. Chemicals are there, and so they absorb some of the light that shines through the atmosphere. And so in about 5 years, 2014, when James Webb Telescope is coming up, we might have, if we're really lucky, the first chance to investigate if other planets are like ours.
That would be incredibly exciting. You know, at the same time, you know, there's this work that you and others are doing to try to figure out how we could identify life on planets orbiting other stars. Well, in the near future, we're going to have the new Mars Science Laboratory. We've detected methane in the Martian atmosphere. People speculated about possible life on some of the icy moons of the outer solar system. If you had to bet money, do you think we'll first find evidence for life within the solar system or on a planet orbiting another star?
If we're lucky, I'd bet on a planet orbiting another star, because if one of them starts to transit, or if one of them goes in front of the star and James Webb can help us with it, then that's 5 years from now. But, of course, being 100% sure that this is life is always going to be a hard question if it's so far away. So we can tell you that we know of no other explanation than this being life. But as you've seen from the point that you just brought up, Mars, methane, there are people who say it's from life. There are people who invoke other explanations. So it's always going to be a big contestion. So we try to find something that's a very solid way to figuring out that there's life. So methane alone will not take for anything that's far away, because even on Mars we're deciding whether or not it's from biota or not.
Yeah, see, that would be my one concern about terrestrial planet finder, is it might find several planets. And I think we're talking planets within a few dozen light years of Earth, and we might see some really interesting spectral signatures on some of these planets. But my guess is we're used to, and this is, I know, a focus of your research, we're used to thinking about planets like Earth and other planets in our solar system. And my guess, you know, based on, you know, history of discovery, is we're going to see some really crazy things out there that nobody is really expecting. We might have good spectra, but the interpretation will be very much subject to debate and somewhat ambiguous if, in fact, we have found life. So do you want to comment on...
Yeah, that's an excellent question and an excellent guess. So we envision a lot of stuff coming up that we will not have anticipated. That's what beauty and actually the fun in science is. You have to figure these things out. But if you make a mission, you have to make it for something that you know how to detect. So we're making it for an Earth analog, and we're working around the clock around figuring out how other planets could actually present themselves to figure out, okay, this looks as if it has way more volcanoes on it. Well, this looks as if it actually has a completely different biota on it. But we'll never be 100% sure on the different biology, because we can't make life in the lab yet. Once you can do that, you could figure out that these gases actually represent this kind of life. So for now, we know what the Earth looks like. So we're going with that as our baseline, but we make 100% sure that the telescopes actually have a wide range to bring us back this fascinating, really interesting, and completely unimagined world that we then have to figure out as we go.
Yeah, I mean, if you just look at planets that have been found through transits and mostly through radial velocity, there's just a huge range of planets with masses, orbits. We found that one planet that's got like 65 Earth masses of solid material. So I would think that the planets that exist in our galaxy have an enormous range, even beyond what even the most creative science fiction writers have imagined.
I completely agree. I think the things that we find we didn't imagine, like 95, the first planet around a solar type star was something nobody had anticipated, and I think a lot of people wished away just so that information
Yeah,
all
that's
sort of
right, yeah.
But the really exciting thing, especially also with Kepler right now, is that it's starting to probe, and with the radio velocity from the ground, they're starting to probe the area of rocky planets. Because right now, until now, our search methods are very biased for the big things and the ones closed in. So you anticipate them to be extremely different. We didn't think they'd exist in the first place, but if they're puffed up, hot, like baked the whole time, you anticipate them to being something that we never expected because we don't have them in our system.
Right, and you mentioned Kepler, which is an ongoing NASA mission, which has already identified a number of new planets and several hundred good candidates for new planets. And my understanding is in a few years, we're going to have really good information about the frequency of Earth-sized planets, but it is that most of these planets that Kepler finds are going to be too far away to be studied directly. Is that correct?
I completely agree. So Kepler was basically envisioned to give us a statistics to tell us how many of these small planets exist. And to do that by basically staring at a star and never missing this tiny amount of time where a planet goes in front of it and thus blocks part of the light, what you need to do is stare at a lot of stars. So you need to stare at a field in the sky where you have a lot of stars roughly the same, and this is why they picked something that's so far away. And this means that for those planets, most of those, we won't be able to follow up. Part of them we will, but just the closest ones. So Kepler is going to give us an idea about how many of these small planets are out there, but the ones that we can really follow up are going to be the ones that are actually close by. And so we need to find those because these are the ones we can actually read and understand.
Right, but what Kepler will tell us, I would think, is how easy or difficult it will be to find a kind of Earth-size, Earth-like planets around nearby stars by giving us, statistical sample of how good stars are at making Earth-like planets.
As you said before, Bob, it found already about 1,000 candidates, so that should give you a first indication of how easy or difficult it seems to be for stars to make planets.
Probably
So
not very difficult.
I have very high hopes that
Yeah.
it's going to come back with amazing results. And one thing to keep in mind is that Kepler will need a little more time because before it can find the
Right.
Earth-like planets, because they need more time. Think about it, our own Earth needs a year to go around the star. So you have to look at it, find it once, then you predict when it's going to come around again, and then if it does it the third time, you have the detection.
So that means for an Earth-like planet around a Sun-like star in an Earth-like orbit, we're talking 3 years of
Yes.
Kepler observations.
So we're talking another 2 years before they're going to confirm the first Earth analogs or be able to find the first Earth analogs. But if you have a smaller star, these orbits
That'll
happen
be
really
tough.
faster because it's closer in, so stay tuned. I really hope we're going to have good news soon.
And I would think when we talk about the total number of planets in our galaxy, we're probably talking minimum 100 billion, but probably even many more than that.
I think what we find from radio velocity, what's an amazing technique currently, is that it seems that there's a pileup of planets for smaller masses. It seems to be that they're more numerous. And if that's true, we already found 450 from the ground that are big gaseous planets. So if the number of the small ones are bigger and we actually start to find them, that means there should be so many around. And among those, there could be a couple of habitats like our own Earth or couple of really weird worlds that's going to be fun to puzzle out.
Yeah, that we can't even predict ahead of time. There was a book that actually was somewhat pessimistic about, at least about complex life, by Ward and Brownlee called Rare Earth that came out about 10, 15 years ago. But even they estimated that the, number of life-bearing worlds in our galaxy is, I don't remember the exact number, but I think they were talking something like 1 billion planets in our galaxy with at least primitive life. Does that sound far-fetched?
It doesn't sound far-fetched insofar that I actually like the book, but I don't really go with its premises because they're arguing that you have to have the exact same conditions for life to evolve, and of course they're taking off, so you actually have to invoke something hitting and killing off the dinosaurs in the first place. But we see that life actually occupies every niche that we can imagine. So it stands to reckon that it's much more likely that lots of different forms of life evolve, and because of circumstances, one becomes the dominant form. And if that's true, then the argument that life should be widespread is very, very valid. And then find a couple of planets. You have water around, you have carbon around, so there should be everything you need for forming life on these planets.
And we keep talking about planets, but I understand that a lot of your recent research is focused on studying moons and what types of environments and what types of moons could also potentially support life. Could you tell us a little bit about what you've been finding?
So actually the fun thing is that one of the Kepler missions things that it can do is it actually could find moons that are as massive as the Earth. And so the question came up, what about these moons? In our own system, you have so many moons to the giant planets. So if you had a bigger planet, you could envision a bigger moon, and then those moons could be Earth analogs as long as they have a really big magnetic field that actually shields them from the radiation. But other than that, we see no reason why they couldn't be habitats, and so all of a sudden, instead of actually having to build a planet that's that small as the Earth, you could have an array of moons that actually could be habitable. But the jury's still out. Kepler has to find them, and then we actually have to see the spectral fingerprint that Jeff was talking about in his article too. It's basically we have to collect the light from this body to figure out if it's analog to Earth, Earth like a long time ago, or Venus or Mars, so that we can figure out if it could potentially be a habitat.
Right, so I guess in this recent movie Avatar, which James Cameron envisions intelligent creatures on a moon orbiting a distant gas giant planet, I guess that scenario in the movie isn't, maybe some aspects of the movie were a bit far-fetched, but at least, you know, that possibility has not at all been ruled out by what we know right now.
Absolutely. I think one of the great things about the movie was that it took a scientific possibility and made it into the story with an amazing 3D effect. But the interesting thing is actually that Cameron picked our closest star, Alpha Centauri, to put a gas giant around, and around that, a moon that's like the Earth. And here science has outpaced science fiction, because we can say that around Alpha Centauri, there is no huge giant planet, because the closest stars we can study really intensely. But there could still be an Earth-like planet that we haven't found yet. But the whole idea, the vision of the movie, yeah, if there's a giant planet, a huge one, it could have a huge moon, and that huge moon could be like Earth. Absolutely out there. Not seen. We don't know anything about it yet, but we can't exclude the possibility. What makes it exciting?
That answers the questions I had. Was there anything else that you would like to add that I did not ask you about?
I think one of the things why I find this research also so interesting is that we have Earth, one sample of a habitable planet. Mm. So if we just get one more or a couple more, we could put Earth in context, and I think that's going to go a long way of understanding and trying to maintain our planet as a habitat. So this is why I think this whole look for rocky planets out there, even if they might not have intelligent life on it, we don't know yet, it's so useful and so important because it sets us in context in a way that we can't do with the sample of one error on Earth in the first place.
And you mentioned intelligent life. I mean, this is the 50th anniversary year of Frank Drake's first modern SETI experiment, where he pointed a radio telescope in Green Bank, West Virginia, at two nearby stars. Obviously we don't really know, but what do you think? Do you think there's a lot of other intelligent life or technological civilizations out there in our galaxy, or like Ward and Brownlee would suggest in their book, maybe intelligent life is very rare?
I think the interesting thing there is that what we're looking for is something that's very analog to us. And I figure that probably there are different ways to evolve. What about if whales became the dominant species or the most intelligent one, and then they stay underwater? Do they build telescopes? Do they not? Do they build radios? Do they not? I think given enough time, life seems to develop further and further and then become intelligent, as we call it. So this is a very personal belief and nothing to back it up. I think it stands to reckon that with so many planets out there, some of them being habitats, chances are really high that life gets to develop to the stage where we call it intelligent. If we're going to recognize it, if we can communicate with it, that's another question. But we're working hard on at least the first part, recognizing when a planet is a habitat and when it could have biota on it that could be deemed intelligent.
Well, Dr. Kallnetter, thank you very much for a very interesting discussion and continued success with your research. And readers of Sky and Telescope, we're all hoping that these telescopes get built and sometime in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we start really getting answers to some of these really big questions.
I think the fascinating thing for people who actually watch the stars is that maybe in 5, 10, 20 years, as you said, we might be able to point to one of the stars and say, look, that's the one that has an Earth-like planet around it that shows all the signs of life. So a picnic under the stars might just become a little more interesting still.
Okay, it's up to you, Congress, to start ponying up the money to make this happen.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
Okay, thank you.